Coming up on Life is a Festival.
Really, the question for anyone using is, what do you want from it? What are you going for? There are a lot of great ways to use ketamine and other substances. A lot of erudition, a lot of self-awareness. So many great ways. That's why we use these substances, because they're really potentially beneficial. But you want to be in touch with yourself. What am I really doing? And you want to make it sacred as much as possible. You don't want to just toot it up and just be tooting all the time. It doesn't make sense to life. So the measure of a substance that's valuable to us is how it changes our lives and makes us, you know, more accomplished, more alive, more communitarian, more, you know, thoughtful human beings, connected human beings. Ketamine's a great connector because it reduces one's sense of ego. It's an ego lysing drug.
Hello, my friends and fellow travelers. Welcome back to Life is a Festival. Today on the show, I have the honor of speaking with an absolute luminary in the world of psychedelics and consciousness expansion. Indeed, he is the godfather of ketamine therapy in many ways, the author of the Ketamine Papers and creator of the Ketamine Lozenge. I am speaking of Dr. Phil Wolfson. This episode is the first time that Phil will be sharing his insights about this mercurial molecule for those who use it recreationally, or as he prefers to term it, ground use. Phil will say this on the show itself, but I want to put it here that Phil does not condone any illegal behavior of any kind and provides his comments strictly for educational purposes. Our conversation starts with Phil's activism experience in the 60s and his perspective on non-therapeutic use of psychedelics. He unpacks ketamine's unique signature as a dissociative anesthetic and its value for therapeutic use, specifically focusing on routes of administration. We navigate the realm of non-clinical, or shall I say, festival ketamine use. I had the chance to pose all of my questions about Special K to Phil, including some of your questions from Instagram. We discuss whether there's a genuine difference between S and R isomers, if one should really spit the drip, so to say, to avoid bladder damage, and if frequent ketamine use leads to memory loss. Most importantly, we address the severity of ketamine dependency. This is a real thing. Ketamine can be physiologically addictive. And I will say, full disclosure, since recording this episode, I've observed my own tendency towards dependency with this molecule, and I've decided to discontinue my recreational ketamine use just to be safe. You know, K-Land is a fascinating place to visit, but it is critical that we not get trapped in the land of the lotus eaters with any substance. Ketamine can be a trickster medicine. It provides potent healing, but it can also derail us from our purpose if we use it unconsciously. And so I am so grateful for Phil's wisdom and direction on this matter. So Dr. Wolfson serves as the president and CEO of the Ketamine Research Foundation and spearheads the Ketamine Training Center. He is the author of the Ketamine Papers and Noe, a father-son song of love, life, illness, and death. He served as the principal investigator for the MAP study on MDMA treatment for those with life-threatening illnesses. And his substantial work in clinical psychiatry and psychedelic medicine spans decades, with interests reaching into politics, secular Buddhism, consciousness, and activism for social and ecological justice. And now, here is Dr. Phil Wolfson. How's your day going today?
Oh, I'm a bit hassled between getting ready to go to New York and all the things I create and overwhelm me. Ketamine Research Foundation with all its projects. I have the within it, it's a nonprofit. Ketamine, the training center with trained over 800 practitioners. So worldwide, we did our first program in Israel internationally. We have another one hopefully coming up in Barcelona in July. Program after program. We're the center really of training. Most of the groups that have been doing training, Lauren you mentioned, Polaris are all people who came out of our training.
Okay, I'm familiar with Polaris.
And then I got a commercial group called Progressive Therapeutics, Inc. I've got writing. I've got the new ketamine papers book, the second one coming up, a book on grief, which I hope to finish maybe sooner than later, and all the clinical stuff that I do here, and people stuff and consulting, and the associates group of over 100 people where we have a every two-week meeting and multiple benefits for membership. Hopefully, as MDMA gets approved, whatever happens with the mushroom psilocybin, we'll see. We'll change it to Psychedelic Psychotherapy Associates. So it's a membership group promoting awareness, education, collaboration around ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. So all my clinical shticks are around ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. I don't like the IV stuff. We can get into that because it's really not a psychotherapy, and it's we could talk all about that.
Yeah, I have some notes about the ketamine infusion clinics. I've actually interviewed a fair amount of people on the
subject
of ketamine.
But it's also the lozenger distribution thing. Those are all my creation of lozenges. So I created with our formulating pharmacy the lozenges that went public and worldwide.
Is there one that's ketamine and oxytocin? I've heard of
I heard someone doing a candy of some sort.
Okay.
Just last week.
Okay.
But I don't know. And oxytocin's controversial.
Okay. Yeah, someone brought that up to me that they're like, oh, now you want to have the ketamine and the oxytocin. It's like, there's always the next thing.
Yeah, the chocolates for ayahuasca.
Ayahuasca chocolates. Now that's a thing. I don't think I would want one.
Oh, you'd be surprised. It's easier to go down.
Really?
Yeah.
You know, I kind of like the taste of ayahuasca at this point.
You're
it's like
a rare
I have
bird.
I have the association with it where it's like, this is the magic potion. So
I have the associate with it tastes like shit.
I don't like the taste of wachuma, like that sort of taste because it's so bitter. But I don't know. The ayahuasca is like a little psychedelic molasses. I don't know why I like it, but
I do. I don't know. Must be your genes or something.
Yeah, maybe genes or maybe just some sort of like association, some trick I've played on my own mind. Phil Wolfson, you are a luminary in the psychedelic space. You are a person who's contributed an extraordinary amount. And from what I understand, you are the absolute best person I can talk to on the subject of ketamine. I've actually been wanting to talk to you for a long time. I'm friends with some of your mentees, some people that you know, some people you've worked with. I'm familiar with the ketamine papers. This is just a real honor to come here to your office in Marin and meet with you and invite you onto the show. So welcome to Life is a Festival.
I'm honored to be here with you, Raymond.
So as I mentioned before we started rolling, there's a lot I want to talk about today and a lot I think our listeners will be really interested in. One thing that I have not heard a podcast about and that it's actually hard to find good information about is this intersection between recreational ketamine use and therapeutic ketamine use. And a lot of people understand that ketamine can be efficacious for depression, OCD, anxiety. And so I think there's a potential issue of recreational ketamine abuse under the aegis of this is therapeutic, this is helpful for me. And so one of the goals that I have during this podcast today is to kind of parse that out and understand what the risks are and understand if people are using ketamine recreationally, what's a appropriate and safe way to do that. And, you know, can we get the benefits that we've seen? And obviously not as much as a psychotherapy assisted session, but are there benefits we can get recreationally? So that's ultimately where I want to go. There's a lot of questions between here and there, but I'm just grateful that you're here and willing to have this conversation with me.
Delighted.
So Phil, let's start with you. Just so that our audience can take a little time to get to know you, I just wanted to start with your activism in the 60s. And you...
The 60s is still alive in me.
Well, that's what, you know, that's
you know,
what...
I... It's not like the 60s died. It's like the convulsions of the 60s. We're not doing very well with 60s kind of ideology or 60s kind of consciousness. We're doing it in small groups, but the world, in my view, is going to hell in a handbasket. And the 60s and those of us who were warriors in the 60s and continued are a little disappointed about where it's gone around misogyny, war, ethnic violence, the prospect of nuclear destruction and the destruction of the environment. We don't see a lot that makes us happy as we move into the passage of the end of life. So it's discouraging. And yet we continue, a bunch of us still continue as if we can still make a dent. I hope we can. So far, the dent is in like people like you, younger people who are espousing good causes, being thoughtful and being activists themselves more we have of that, the better off we are. But it's a very hard time. It's a very discouraging time for all of us. Having children and grandchildren, and I don't have any grandchildren. I'm hoping for one. But looking ahead for young people and babies being made and all the rest, it's pretty scary, pretty damn scary.
So in the 60s, psychedelics seemed like they might be the agent of change in the world.
That they were. If, you know, they still are.
I guess that's the question. Is it, at the time, this is the dawning of the age of Aquarius that's going to bring this period of peace, this everlasting peace.
Don't bring up the Bee Gees, please.
I'm curious how your perspective on psychedelics as agents for change in the world has changed over time from the 60s to today.
Well, I've been actually writing a lot on that. I have a new paper I'm excited about writing, which explores that issue in a philosophical depth. I never thought that psychedelics in and of themselves were fully agents of change. They certainly are agents of change. They can be extremely positive agents of change, particularly as I look at what MDMA and ketamine do in therapeutic contexts, agents of change. I think they're less bivalent and more directional in terms of promoting change.
What does bivalent mean?
There's a non-specific amplifier concept that Stan Grof brought into play, arguing, of course, that LSD was a positive kind of experience, which it can be in an appropriate setting. It can also be a very disturbing experience, and we know psychedelic agents of that kind have been used negatively. You know, CIA, Manson, we got all kinds of stories. Weatherman, it's been used by military in all sorts of ways, probably still is. And exploration of new psychedelic agents by military and spy agencies and all of that continues. So the idea that it's one direction and it's all positive isn't so. It's really about set and setting, what you bring to it and where you do it. We had quite a few casualties they're not admitted to in the 60s, and people doing it too young in bad settings. I had a 13-year-old neighbor who did it, and they had moved away from Noe Valley where I raised my kids, and she did it with out in the open in the hate and had several episodes and became quite psychotic and is not really recovered. Now, that's uncommon, but to pose it as universally positive is a mistake. Sasha Shulgin tended to have that view that psychedelics were enough. Of course, Sasha, who was a close friend, came out of the development of most of the agents that we have in use. He synthesized them or brought them back, like MDMA from obscurity in 1912 and 1914. So Sasha had a view that it was enough. But that, I thought, was always controversial because enough. How do you change your basic self that guides you? It's complicated. It requires other things. You mentioned your interest in Buddhism or spirituality. I think that's a contribution. Relationship, love, all the things that go into leading a full life, in which psychedelic agents, alternative medicines, are used and help in that, but are also situated within the depth of that kind of evolving experience of self and community. So I don't think there's a single dimension to psychedelics. And you asked about ketamine and recreational use. I don't like recreational as a word. I use it sparingly because it's been so used against people who are coming alive with psychedelic medicines. I tend to call it the ground. And then there's recreation. There are people just, you know, buzzing off, just taking a dose of this or that just to get out of themselves or to leave their misery or just to have a high. But those of us, almost all of us in this world, if you look at the people who are involved in the research, you know, the elders of the group and the younger people, most of us came to this not in its psychotherapeutic format. We had experiences. And those experiences were the teachers of the worthwhileness of doing the medicine. That's what happened to me. I mean, I did my first experience in 1964, 8 of us in medical school at NYU, on the roof of our building, which was a little hazardous. We all lived in dormitories. Dropped acid. We didn't know what we were doing. And it was a little scary, a little wacko. And it was life-changing in the sense of the breadth of our inner experience was so enlarged. marijuana. I think of marijuana as a great friend to me. And that came shortly after, and it really helped me with self-consciousness. I was a very self-conscious young guy. And I changed a lot. I started to like dancing. I started to like love. I think marijuana is a great love drug. So is ketamine, a great love drug used in certain ways. And I find marijuana very hallucinatory. So I think marijuana is a psychedelic, and I promote it that way, as do McQueen and other people. But I think we've always promoted that, and some people have profound experiences, and about 40% of people don't do well on marijuana. But nonetheless, going back to the question, I think almost all of us came to the experience in group, as in my first experience in Esalen when we had the ARUPA group, the Association for Responsible Use of Psychedelic Agents in the mid-80s, where MDMA really came alive as a psychotherapeutic adventure, but we were legal. And much of what we learned in that period, virtually all of us clinically that we learned, all that we learned clinically, is basically what there still is. Now we have neuroscience, but neuroscience is reductionist. But the clinical use was profound. So is that recreational or the ground? I mean, you know, we did a lot of psychotherapy, and we also did a lot of self-exploration. And I think self-exploration is totally legitimate. And I don't want to call it recreational. I want to call mindless use of substances or aversive use that is, you know, tranquilizing oneself rather than exploring oneself. Okay. You know, that's not even recreational. That's trying to get out of your own way or trying to blitz yourself so you don't feel the pain that you feel or the lack of motivation or whatever. So there is that. But I think I want to honor the 60s and thereafter and honor people who are doing the medicine work because they want to explore themselves and explore their friendships, explore community. And within that framework, we can develop a critical view of use.
I really appreciate that reframe. I feel like a festival, which is my landscape that I'm often in, Burning Man, participatory events that are helpful containers for this type of play and self-experimentation. These are actually great set and settings in certain ways. Sometimes it's overwhelming, it's too much. But to have something like the Zendo Project, sure, psychedelic peer support, and to be in an environment where people are intentionally investigating themselves. So if you meet a fellow traveler along the way, they might have a piece of wisdom for you that is part of your experience. I love the reframe. Let's not call it recreational because of the way that delegitimizes that self-exploration. Let's call it, what do we call it? Do we have
I'm calling it the ground.
The ground?
Rather than the underground.
Okay, the ground. I like that. Okay.
Is the underground because of illegality. Scheduling created the underground. There was no underground before. When it's legal, there's no underground. There's the ground. There's recreational. There's therapeutic. Those are the uses of the medicine. And if we were only legal, which I would love to see, you know, we would support it with education and we'd support it with support like Zendo. I've been part of Zendo and a spiritual emergency network and things like it, which support consciousness and use in a thoughtful way and pick up on casualties if they occur. But I think legal, the scheduling and making illegitimate and illegal and arrest prone for possession or use was a terrible blow and a really extraordinary reactionary blow by Nixon and his coterie and all those straight people who think they know how to suppress us and what's best for us. And I've been promoting legalization every way we can. And one of the outcomes, unfortunately, of the clinical research development has been that it becomes like pharma, because to get it through FDA, as I'm aware, because I'm working on doing things with FDA, to get it through FDA is a multi-year, extremely costly process, and you end up with a very expensive so-called therapeutic setting, which is mandated by FDA, so that groups like MAPS, which have done stunning work, and I've been part of MAPS doing that research, you end up with a prohibitively expensive kind of drug with inadequate insurance, because United States has terrible insurance, if it exists even, and mental health when it does. And so it's a contradiction. So you know, the devotion to getting things legal for medical psychotherapeutic use also creates a kind of pharma approach to it, because that's the only way you can get it through. So what that really does is it promotes underground use, because the costs of having a pharma-based kind of MDMA, or if it happens, a psilocybin or other, are so prohibitive that no one can afford it. So what it does is promote an unregulated psychotherapeutic market that we call the underground. And it promotes, of course, ground use for people who are thoughtful, and it promotes avoidance of psychotherapy because it's too costly. And there aren't that many good psychotherapists, frankly.
So first of all, your first ketamine experience was in the 90s.
90.
You had a profound experience such that you waited 10 years before you had another one,
yep,
as I understand. And so I'd love to use that experience as a doorway into what is profound about ketamine specifically. There's a litany of psychedelics to choose from. What is it for you in the experiences you've had subjectively, but also in your understanding of the pharmacology, the clinical value of ketamine? What is it that makes this particular molecule so special?
Well, now you're getting into me giving you a lecture, because this is one of the things I train people at length about. But it's useful to think of psychedelic medicines as having each a signature. And there's been, I think, an unfortunate lumping into classical psychedelics, which I don't think really exist, and that's based on 5-HT2A serotonergic activity. But we've moved much further than that. And we know that if you lump that group, then what's the differentiation between mescaline or, you know, 5-MeO or LSD, et cetera? They each have different characteristics, and they each overlap. And probably when we get more sophisticated, we'll see differences either in fMRI or more particularly in receptor intracellular kind of differences that will explain it. But I think most of it is at the level of neural networks and what is stimulated or repressed by specific substances. So each substance has its own identity, and there's a vast overlap. Ketamine has a vast overlap in terms of it being at higher dosage a profound hallucinogen, which is not totally dissimilar than, for instance, any of the other major psychedelics. It's short acting, which is good for psychotherapy, makes it less expensive, makes it more clinically adaptive. It is as profound a journey as anyone could take. And people who are very experienced in this world come to ketamine and have profound experiences and make exclamations like, wow, this is the most extraordinary thing I've ever done. So going back to my first experience, within the framework of a ketamine experience, it was the most extraordinary thing I'd done. So what I experienced were multiple things. One was that it took me out of form. So, you know, Buddhists are fond of talking about emptiness is form is emptiness, all that kind of silly stuff in a way that doesn't really tell us what it's about, but it's a slogan. And so ketamine makes us experience ourselves as pure energy forms, depending on dosage and sensitivity. We always look at sensitivity for psychedelics, not milligrams per kilogram, because that's not really a basis for knowing how each of us will react. And there's great variety. A small person can be very insensitive. A big person can be highly sensitive. So that's true for all psychedelics.
And there's a tolerance piece as well with ketamine too.
In that I don't experience much of that.
Okay.
So not in our clinical setting. We could talk about that in street setting. But in our clinical setting or in my personal life, no, I haven't seen tolerance. Occasionally, we have people where we are in a protocol, which is might be daily for 10 days. But over the years, very few people develop insensitivity to lozenges or to IM, our two methods. But going back to the signature, so you leave your body. Ketamine's an anesthetic, so one part of its signature is it takes away your external sensory inputs, and it puts you entirely into internal sensory inputs. Well, it turns out when we really experience ourselves, we have a constant visual stream going. And ketamine makes that more obvious, more alive. You could tune into that with marijuana too. I always put it about 3 inches behind my head. And there you can watch and see what's going on even with your eyes open if you get sensitive to it. So one is it takes you out of here and now. And for people, for instance, who are depressed or struggling, taking you out of here and now is beneficial. But the integration part, which we do in within the framework of psychotherapy, which people don't tend to do when they're doing it solo or outside of a therapeutic context, the integration part is seeing how you're different. So you come back and you've had a hiatus between your going in mind, your ordinary mind, the experience of ketamine, coming back. And there's really an opportunity and a kind of vector within the medicine to reform yourself, to get to another kind of operational overall self that's working you better than you went one you went in with. So, for example, people who come in saying, I'm a depressed human, don't have a depressed experience with ketamine because its affect tends to be neutral to positive, almost entirely universally, even though there's agitation or there's an enactment of the trip that looks like agitation. So you come back, there's an opportunity. It's not entirely developed or present in every human. There's an opportunity to reflect on your difference and to feel different. And that's part of the integration. How do we anchor those differences? How do we help people move on? And generally, it takes more than one session to really start to move into other kind of consciousness. And it's great when there's good support for that. So those are some of the signatures. It can be sensual, not very sensual. It's very sensual if you create a sensual environment. And it's very intimate in that. So in an intimate sense, ketamine, moving between, let's say you're partnered with someone of whatever gender you wish to be partnered with, and you get naked with them, and you lie in bed with them, and you do a substantial dose, you get very close. And as you come back, it can even become quite sexual. It stops the sexuality for a period of time. But then as you're intimate, it promotes a kind of sense of loving connection, and sexuality comes out of that. So that's a wonderful experience we're talking more and more about. There are other aspects to the signature, but those are pretty much the major ones.
So, a question about the signature. So, in my experience using ketamine, and I've used a lot of street ketamine in my life, it seems like it's a single molecule that can give such radically different experiences. And I understand that there's two isomers. Often when we're discussing this sort of socially around ketamine, it's like, oh, well, this is S-ketamine, so that means it's more psychedelic, or this is R-ketamine, that means it's less psychedelic. I'm curious, perhaps the isomer stuff is all BS. I don't really know.
It is entirely bullshit. We could talk
about it. Is it entirely bullshit? Okay,
well,
I had
I'll
a suspicion.
I'll give it to you clearly. The stuff that's in general use is not S-ketamine. That's Spravato, which is poorly dosed, et cetera. So it's RS, right and left-handed isomers of ketamine. The right-handed one is not really in commercial availability. You might get it in the dark web. There's no reason to get it. It's a quarter of the strength psychedelically of the S-ketamine. So, and the S-ketamine is twice as strong as the mixture, but the mixture is 50-50. So you're getting 50% R, 50% S, 75% of the effect, more or less, is the S-ketamine. There's no separation. They're both very psychedelic, depending on concentration dose. You stick with the basic material, RS, there's no issue. There's no superiority going to S-ketamine. You might use less, because it's more powerful, harder to get. Stick with the RS.
I'm happy to put that to bed because there's nothing more boring than being on ketamine talking about isomers. The bigger question here is, if I take LSD, I'll have different experiences, but yes, the general signature, the experience of LSD stays pretty consistent. Similar for ayahuasca.
I don't agree with that.
Really?
I think LSD is totally variable.
You find it very... I feel like it's not as variable as ketamine. Because for me, ketamine sometimes will give me a bunch of energy. Sometimes it'll make me feel super sedated. With LSD, it's kind of stringy. It kind of pulls you every which way. LSD seems to do a similar thing, even though that thing is quite varied. Whereas I feel like when I take ketamine, I kind of don't know what I'm going to get. Like, I don't know if it's going to be a full-on, what we call a K-hole, which we should rebrand that.
Transformational space.
Transformational space, yeah. When someone says K-hole, we really need a rebrand.
Well, you know the story of the K-hole? You want to know the story?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Okay, so the K-hole comes out of military use of ketamine. We were taught this by a special forces medic. So the foxhole is where people get wounded and injured often. And a medic will come in with syringe full of ketamine, jump into the foxhole, and produce the ketamine effect by an injection, taking the soldier who's dismembered or wounded or whatever out of their consciousness and into the K-hole, okay? So it's the foxhole being attended to by a medic who's giving ketamine to block people from the actual torture of their experience.
Okay, well, even more reason to rebrand it. I have a friend who calls it K-Land. He's like, we're going to K-Land, which seems... K-Hole seems like it's something you might accidentally fall into.
You fall into a hole. No, but let's go back to your point. I agree ketamine is entirely unpredictable in some ways. I mean, at the beginning, one knows that one is going to enter other realities. So there's a predictability to the entrance point. Where you go in those realities, the degree in which you're in an altered reality that's totalistic, which is one of the other aspects of the signature, when you take enough medicine and you're sensitive to it, you will live for a while in another reality. That reality will have no relationship to this space that you came from. And that's an important part of it. It's an important part of the art of doing ketamine. But the adventure of ketamine is unpredictable.
I like the adventure of ketamine. And we are going to get to, towards the end of the episode, the pitfalls to avoid in the adventure of ketamine, because I think that's something that's really important for all of us.
Sure.
I want to talk about ground ketamine, street ketamine outside of the therapeutic session. But before we do that, let's just touch on ketamine-assisted psychotherapy. And there are a few things that I'd like our audience to be aware of around the use of ketamine for psychotherapy, which, first of all, there's this question of administration, intravenous, intramuscular, encephalation, or ingestion. Festival use ketamine is often encephalated. Encephalated?
Insufflated.
Okay, I only read it. Insufflated. I'm trying to be fancy. You snort it.
You are fancy.
I feel so seen. Tell me a bit about the methods of administration and why one uses a certain method and what the value is.
Well, it's about the history of ketamine. So ketamine is an anesthetic agent. And when it first began to be explored, it was explored by psychiatrists in academic settings, and it has a complex history. But because it's Schedule 3 and an anesthetic without any specific indication, to get a drug into FDA approval has to have an indication. So like psilocybin struggled with life-threatening illness, which was not a DSM-5 indication. They had to switch to depression. Ketamine we're using in our company for menstrual symptoms because it's great at low dose for menstrual symptoms. So the anesthesia people had control of the substance. It was theirs. And so they saw the gold mine of doing ketamine IV because they're anesthesia people. They do it medically. They have no psychiatric training. So what happened was that there was a suppression, of course, of the war on drugs in about 1999, 2000, of ketamine psychedelic nature, which was well known. Janssen's book came out through MAPS, and I think it was the first edition, it was 2001. The nature of psychedelic experience on ketamine was well known probably since the patent of ketamine occurred in 1970. There are always people, as you know, looking to find a new high. And ketamine was a new high. And we have a lot of information on that and its use, including with Stan Grof and Maryland Psychiatric Institute. Anyway, the boys who did this, and it was all boys, wanted to suppress any notion of psychedelic experience. So they created an arbitrary dosage format of 0.5 milligrams per kilogram dosed in an IV bag over 40 minutes. That was the standard. One dose didn't work. They got up to six doses, which had an effect. The studies on IV use, there's a recent McInnes study, and that shows about 30% of efficacy for depression within placebo. But we think it does work as a medicine in its own, but not at the level that IV people are talking about. So one, it was a gold mine. You could have an anesthesiologist or a psychiatrist running nurses producing four or six or eight beds at a time for 40 minutes. It fit into the 50-minute hour. You needed a little time for recovery. You didn't do it with music. You never did it yourself. You didn't know what you were doing to people, and you never processed their experience. So a lot of people came out of IV and still do, saying, what was that all about? But the dosage also went up because the efficacy at 0.5 milligrams per kilogram became more and more recognized as insufficient for many people. Even at 0.5 milligrams per kilogram, people had hallucinatory experiences, because some people are truly sensitive at very low dose. So dosages have gone up even to 2 milligrams per kilogram as they do this work. And it's a fortune. So you can imagine if a guy, and it's mostly guys, there are some women, let's say you have four beds and you're running eight people in a day at $650 a shot, and you have a nurse and you're hardly present, and you got some IV equipment, boom, you're making a fortune. So the basic rule of ketamine, and this applies to street, is that ketamine experience is based on how much you get in and how quickly you get it into you. So the IV bolus is the quickest way to get in. Second is the IM shot, which we use.
That's the intramuscular.
Intramuscular. That takes 2 to 3 minutes and is a profound and great way to administer ketamine. Very accurate. You can do more than one shot if you time it well. And ketamine has a rapid metabolism, so timing is everything. And we developed the lozenger. Originally, the lozenger was a kind of waxy thing. It's still in use. But I wanted the lozenger to come on quickly, dissolve quickly, because it's the saliva that carries the ketamine, and the ketamine is in the saliva is being absorbed through the lining of your mouth and tongue. It's through mucosa. It can be done through the anal mucosa. It can be done through the vaginal mucosa.
That's boofing. That's like boofing. Yeah. I love boofing as a name.
Well, you got to make sure you keep it in the anal ring. If you stick it in your intestine, you're not going to get it. But anyway, that's important information.
It's important, yeah. If you're going to boof, you heard it from Phil. Yeah. Don't go all the way up.
Just don't go all the way up. Okay. So we developed the lozenger. Why did we stick with the lozenger as opposed to intranasal, which is Spravato? Because early in our encounter with practitioners, we saw and heard about bad use of ketamine. So you would do, if you had an intranasal spray, you could do squirt, 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 squirt. And so people were getting dependent on ketamine because there's a real issue for people's dependency. We haven't had it clinically, but we have seen it in people who left us who got really hooked. So getting hooked on ketamine is not a good thing. It's ugly. It leads to cravings. It's hard to get off of. And it is destructive. So you don't want to do ketamine too frequently and in too high a dose, because you will eventually get dependent. And that's a really bad trip. People go into treatment. The withdrawal is not that bad compared to coke or compared especially to opiates, but it's not a good experience to get hooked on ketamine.
I want to put a pin in the physiological addictive quality of ketamine, because I think that's not properly understood by people who are using it outside of therapeutic space. So I want to come back to that. But there's a question I had about the method of administration. When I first started using ketamine, the big concern was that it would lead to kidney and bladder damage. And basically what people would say is, okay, so it's actually what the molecule is breaking down into. And it was like you'd snort it, and then the drip in the back of your throat was going to turn into something that would damage your kidney or bladder. So you always were supposed to spit the drip out. So you'd take the ketamine, it'd drip, and you'd spit it, and then you were fine. But otherwise, you might damage your kidney or bladder. People, is that BS?
People fall for all kinds of bullshit. So let's take it for real. Okay. First of all, the bladder issue, which is specific to ketamine, and the format of it, the nature of the bladder difficulty relates to large quantities of ketamine used frequently. Studies show a gram or 2 grams, but I would say if you're using half a gram a day and you're doing it a lot, you have a risk of bladder. It's an interstitial bladder cystitis. So a few things about it. We don't think doing ketamine that frequently at that dose is worthwhile, period. It's just obliteration, much like alcoholism, much like any getting out of here kind of thing. It doesn't lead to a good quality of life. We see it with other substances, you know, that people are getting hooked on, even related to ketamine. So consistent use at high dose leads to that. Now, spitting, discharging it from your nose has nothing to do with it. There's one set of studies that suggest that the metabolite, the principal metabolite of ketamine, norketamine, sitting in the bladder is causative. We don't know that for sure. That may be so. How do you get to norketamine? You're going to get it no matter what. But if you swallow ketamine, you get more norketamine because you're avoiding first pass. So if you take it in the nose or orally or IM, it's not going right away through the liver, so you have much less norketamine produced. If you swallow orally or swallow what's gone down your nose in quantity, you're going to get much higher levels of norketamine. We did a study on this with lactation for determining how long women had to withhold breastfeeding to not affect their neonate. So we have a pretty good eye on this in terms of quantification.
Wait, so you do spit the drip then?
It's better, well, it's better not to swallow, period.
Okay.
If you're going to use higher quantities, spit it, not because it's going to cause it directly, but because you're going to get higher levels of norketamine if you swallow it.
Okay.
The absorption in the gut is much lower.
And the anyway. And the lozenge is saliva, so you're not swallowing, you're not ingesting it.
Well, we don't use lozenges frequently that it'll produce that kind of high dose experience. So lozenges, we do at certain points urge people to spit out because the higher dose, like we'll go up to 300 milligrams of lozenges held for 15 minutes, which is our, you know, arbitrary point of how long you hold the saliva. There's an increased risk of nausea. So that's why we spit out. We're not worried about the norketamine effect.
So this is going to be my last question about therapeutic use of ketamine before I use myself as a cautionary tale for the sake of our audience. So my last question here is, you know, we talked about the routes of administration. I'm not sure if we fully landed on that. You were saying that you use intramuscular. So let's talk about that and let's lead that into just a kind of a broad view of what the value is of therapeutic use of ketamine. What are people getting out of it? What
sure.
have you seen?
Great question. So we use IM in variable dosage. People way back called low-dose LSD psycholytic. So we call it by that name. So a low dose of ketamine is helpful to helping people, A, not be too worried about losing their orientation, because ketamine is disorienting, especially to newbies. But it's also evocative for psychotherapeutic use. So we use low-dose ketamine, IM. We use variable dosing to higher doses as we see people's ability to tolerate it and as we find that the higher dose also produces a therapeutic experience. So we see ketamine and its variability from a lower-dose IM or a dose of the lozenge, which we usually start people off with, as all of them potentially being therapeutic for people in various ways. We use the high dose to really get people into another state. And do we know that state is better than the others, lower dose state? Probably not. We use them as together. We also do home use of the lozenges. We never give out the injectable format. But lozenges at home support the work and make it much less expensive and affordable for people. We're unique in our clinic in that we have a sliding scale, and our nonprofit foundation, the Ketamine Research Foundation, has an access to care which we apply to indigent people on the basis of application of members in our Membership Associates Group. So we're trying to serve the people in a general sense. And our costs are about a quarter of what an IV clinic costs because we have the home use. So we're not getting people into the clinic six times in a row.
Is the home use, is that telemedicine? Are they doing like a Zoom call while taking it?
No, they're involved with us.
Okay.
And we do it after we feel people are safe to do it. We urge them to have someone at home to help them if they have to go to the bathroom, not fall. And we do it on the basis of repeated session. People come in and we get emails, phone, et cetera, in which we're supporting them, but we're not monitoring it. We believe people's agency is important once they know what they're doing, and we ask people to write reports and tell us about what they're doing. So I think it's a much more inclusive and satisfying experience for people.
This is a great time for one of my favorite soapboxes. So this is one of my favorite soapboxes, which is, if psychedelic medicine helps all of us advance in certain ways, heal trauma, become more creative, and it is prohibitively expensive, then these beautiful medicines are only going to widen inequality. So we have to have equity and access for psychedelics, because otherwise it actually just makes the problem of inequality worse. Because if people can afford to use these amazing medicines that allow them to compete better in a capitalist market, then they basically just, it just makes the rich people richer, right? So what you're doing, what you're saying that you're doing here, is you're creating more access, creating sliding scale, you're making it so that people who need this are more able to get it. So I just wanted to note, appreciate you for doing that, and note that equity and access and really helping all people and the people who need it most access psychedelic medicine is hugely important.
Well, I mean, I think that's a good wrap, but I think it's a little limited.
Okay, nice. Okay, good.
Because I think the issue is legalization. So the costs, as they go up, promote the use of it outside of a therapeutic context. Therapeutic contexts need to be controlled in terms of cost, whether it's us or it's MAPS eventually, or it's, you know, the psilocybin people, whoever wins the finish line on that. The problem is you want people to avail themselves of psychotherapeutic use of these medicines in an affordable way with full access. The solution to that is legalization, because as you spend all this money to get into a prescriptive kind of use of a medicine, you have to charge a lot of money to make it back. And the REMS, as it's called from FDA, as for MAPS, you know, are going to be quite expensive and prohibitive. And if you look at what FDA did with Spravato, it's very ineffective dosing. It's at great cost. People don't need to use it. So Spravato, without insurance, is about $1,000 plus 2 hours in a psychiatrist's office, has to be a psychiatrist, plus you have to be on an antidepressant in order to be able to qualify for it. A lot of games around that. Well, if you did intranasal in an off-label clinic of our sorts, we don't do much intranasal, but if you did, it's going to be about $20, $30 compared to the $1,000. So what does that promote, as you might imagine? It promotes, in this case, it promotes therapeutic use in other contexts other than use of Spravato, which is not a good dosage anyway, not effective. And what it really promotes, if you look in a more general sense, is it promotes a sense of, I can't afford that. Let me go to someone underground who's going to charge me $1,500, you know, for a day-long session, or I'm going to get some and do it with friends. So the whole kind of distortion is based on the illegalization of the medicines. That's where the basics lie. So when we were legal, in that legal period, an MDMA session ran for 3 to 5 hours, depending on who was doing it. The cost was $300 to $500 for a psychotherapeutic session with someone who was probably decent. That's a reference point to $15,000 to $25,000 that we're going to come up with. So if you really look at the distortions, and medicines are pretty cheap on the street still, right? You can get LSD probably for $5, maybe, if you're lucky. You can get a gram of MDMA for probably $200. You know, that's 8 doses if you do it according to Hoyle. You know, so street costs are much less. And why wouldn't you avail yourself of it? But that's the promotion of illegalization. It pushes things and people into distorted relationships. Not to say in a legal period there wouldn't be problems. There were problems. There will be problems. There'll be people who are just taking medicines to get out of here, have an experience, antidote their pain or their confusion about life or how to situate in this world. There'll always be those problems. That's why we have Zendos. That's why we have education. That's why we have support. But making it illegal has made it. The first year in MDMA, 1986, we had probably maybe there were 100,000 people using, went to 3 million in 1 year as soon as it got illegal. And the number of people worldwide using psychedelics, it's blossoming. I've never seen so much drug use as in this period of time. Substance use, alternative medicine use. It's amazing how many people are doing it. Amazing. I was in Israel, and people are using marijuana. Orthodox are using marijuana. 5-MeO is available in Israel. I mean, you know, it's wacko. It's gone all over.
Well, and I love that personally. I think cognitive liberty
like
is the
too.
Vibe. You know,
I like that too.
Yeah. Well, of course,
no,
you
I'm
like that. I mean, you're one
do
of the
it.
Warriors.
Do it. Just don't get busted for it.
Yeah. And do it safely and do it in
do
support
it in
of
a good way. Yeah.
And do it in support of each other, which is so important.
Help each other.
Just to sort of tie up this section of the conversation, what do you see as the value of ketamine that you're seeing
well,
in your office? That
we have this. You're in my clinic. We have extraordinary experiences. I would say, you know, 85%. We have one paper, we're working on others. About 85% of people improve their lives in substantial ways. About 15% or so we can't do much with. But the miracles, the rapidity of ketamine work, it's glorious and we love it. I've been doing this for over 50 years, and working psychedelically in a psychotherapeutic context, I love it. I still love it. I'm turned on by it. I'm turned on by what happens to people and so are my practitioners. And that's why it spread so wide. There are two reasons for its spread. One, money, because people are making a lot of money on doing this work. But the main reason, I think, for good people is that it's miraculous. Not always, not without difficulty, but it's miraculous. I mean, we're doing training groups of 36 people. Our view is that in our 5-6-day workshops, we want practitioners to know the value of the medicine, to do it themselves, because any psychedelic should be known from our point of view in terms of what it does to yourself. Before you give it to someone else, you at least have that reference point. Well, when you create a group, we stop at 36 because we can only handle so many people over 5 days administering ketamine. In this case, the experience of the group cohesion leads to 11. And every time we do it, we've done maybe 25, 26 of these experiences. So over 800 practitioners, many of whom have gone on to do other trainings or clinical work. And we're espousing clinical work with ketamine because it's a wonderful experience when done well for people coming in. We're treating people off the street. We're not just treating, you know, Richie Rich is coming to us. We have some of that, but we're basically treating people who hear about us, who come to us, and we're a broad psychiatric clinic. So one of the limitations on all the other ways that are promoted is they don't take people in their real essences of struggle and suffering. You know, you have a mind boom clinic, you have not a clinic, a mind boom dispensary, basically sending out fairly uncontrolled medicine to people, not really having an engagement, and it's brutal in a lot of ways, and it's money-making in a lot of ways, and it doesn't really speak to the needs of, you know, people who are suffering, which are complex. It's depression is a complex thing. PTSD is a complex thing to work with. It requires great delicacy and thoughtfulness and training. It's not simple to be a psychedelic practitioner, and you need to know the substance yourself. So that's what we're promoting now, self-knowledge, group experience, because a group of 36 people doing what we do over 5 days has an experience of those 36 people sharing what their experience is. So it's like a clinical upgrade. You got 36 experiences before you do another set of people on your own who are coming to you for psychiatric care. And we promote doing broad-based psychiatric care. So that answers, I hope, some of what you looked for.
You know, that method of just sending it and not monitoring it.
Yeah.
I actually have a family member who has very serious mental health issues, Vietnam, just a lot of trauma. And he was starting to do ketamine. And in the beginning, it was like helped his depression, kind of woke him up a bit. He's on a daily dose where the dose keeps getting higher and his condition is deteriorating.
That's how you make money.
Yeah. And so, you know, there's a lot of, you know, what are we going to do to help this guy? Because this is supposed to be medicinal, but it's not actually therapeutic. It's just giving this medicine. And through my own experiences with ketamine, I can see how ketamine, we've talked about this earlier, it is physiologically addictive. It can be like the alcohol of psychedelics in a sense. Like you can use it like alcohol. You can just keep using it and step out of yourself and escape yourself and not actually process things. So my concern about MindBloom and things like it, you know, is that it's not really a creation of care and support. It's just kind of administering a drug. And the medicine is about how it is used. It's kind of like the pharmacon idea. It's like it can be poison if it is used inappropriately, and it can be healing if it's used appropriately. And that's an important distinction.
So MindBloom and its ideology addressed some very important issues in the field. That is, access to care was very limited. Number of trained people doing the work was limited, and the ability to reach far and wide at a reasonable cost was extremely limited. Because of COVID, we had telepsychiatry, which is continuing until for another 6 months, the end of the year. They just extended it, DEA. But that was the basis, because in fact, we can only treat so many people. There are only so many practitioners. There are only so many practitioners of worth. You know, that's why we're trying to accelerate training programs so that more people can benefit from good quality of administration therapeutically of ketamine. Ketamine's great in proper administration for PTSD. It's absolutely fabulous.
So we're going to kind of transition a little bit more into a focus of off of the couch, street use, ground use. But I like off the couch, maybe as a nice expression for it.
Most of us sit on the couch or lie on the couch. I have to lie down for ketamine. I don't know about you.
Yeah.
A lot of people stand up and dance. I've seen that. Most of us who take ketamine, most of us lie down. I don't know how people stand up and dance on ketamine.
I stand up until I can stand up no more. I like to joke that I don't like going to parties where you can't lie down. If I go to a party and there's nowhere to like lounge, I'm like, I'm going to be on my feet all night. This is awful.
Yeah.
Considering your enormous experience with this particular molecule, how might someone who wanted to use this medicine at a festival or with a small group at home, outside of a therapeutic context, what's the best way to be using this in a non-clinical setting to optimize our experiences?
Let me not promote a sense of illegal use of ketamine. Let me speak to it under freedom of speech, but I'm not promoting illegal use, okay?
Important distinction. Neither am I, by the way.
I have a license. I don't like to lose it. And I do want people to use it safely and use it thoughtfully. So I'm happy to discuss it in terms of recommendations about proper use, okay?
Perfect.
So that's my caveat about it. It's, you know, all over the map. So most people, as you know, are insufflating it. They're putting it up their nose. They're putting it up powder. So the first issue is adulteration. Does ketamine have adulterants? Yes. And so it's not pervasive, but where you get your stuff from, you know, how it's made is important.
And there is fentanyl now in all sorts of powder, so testing substances is
not
hugely
just
important.
Fentanyl, but fentanyl is usually important. We're aware of deaths, not specifically from ketamine, but adulterated substances of all sorts. People overdosing, young people, it's a terrible loss when it happens, and it's happening too often. So there's always money behind things that, you know, screw things up. Money screws things up. The biggest drug of all, I'm fond of saying, is money. And true. So, you know, it's important to know where you're getting it from and that it's okay. I'm not clear if DanceSafe has a test for ketamine.
They do, yeah.
They do.
DanceSafe has a really good fentanyl test, yeah. And I'll put a link in the show notes to where you can purchase fentanyl tests from DanceSafe.
I'd appreciate that. I think that's really important. DanceSafe is a great organization. The other thing, you know, is what you do it with. People don't always do ketamine straight. They do it with lots of other things. Drug interactions with ketamine are not particularly prohibitive or hurtful, but they may put you down for a while. Ketamine and marijuana is a wonderful combination where it's legal, you know, like in California. We promote the use of it together because marijuana makes ketamine a little more colorful, a little sweeter, the come down easier. So clinically, we use it as well, and we promote its use clinically in our teachings and in our work. No, not everyone does it, and it's important to use it if you don't like marijuana just in advance of the ketamine experience. In terms of amount, the more you do, the more trouble you have, you know. So people are going to not know how much to put up their nose right away. So, you know, go slow, see where you go.
You can always do more. You can never do less.
Exactly. And the timing is important. So ketamine is rapidly metabolized. So no matter how much you take, you're going to pretty much come down on the curve at the same time. That's usually 45 minutes. You know, if you're going to pump it up, you're going to have to do it fairly soon, like 15 minutes. If you're going to do lozenges, if you do it in your nose, you're going to try and have to hold it powder and you're going to lose some of its potency. It's going to drip down the back of your throat. You talked about spitting that out. Swallowing is not a terrible thing depending on quantity. The more you do in a row, you know, the more you have hazards, driving, etc. You really don't want to operate machinery or drive on ketamine. It's not a good idea. It's not a good idea in any of the substances, as far as I'm concerned. You know, we don't let people go here till they're safe. And at home use, we caution people not to drive or use machinery. So those are important contextual questions. Frequency of use is also of concern. So people who are doing it daily most likely are going to get caught doing higher doses to keep up with it, not just because of tolerance, but because they're going to want to follow the effect upwards so that they're going to want to go and explore how deep can they go, how far can they go, what's the transformational space, aka K-hole, going to hold for them. And we watched addictive patterns. We watched Willie, who really was shooting up all the time, covered with abscesses during his days, John Willie. And I think it was a casualty of ketamine and medicines in general. He used too much. But I've seen other people really get lost on it and have to go through clinical detox experiences and programs. It's not frequent. It's interesting. There was a BBC program on the town in southern China that was producing ketamine in league with the officials in the town. And they eventually all got swept away so other people in China could make money. But they had to start a clinic for dependency in China because they were shooting and putting it up their own nose or shooting it up because they were making so much of it. They had a lot of people get dependent on ketamine.
Question about frequency. So, and obviously you're not condoning this, but is there a frequency at which someone should not go over? So obviously you don't want to be doing it every day, but if someone is doing it, let's say like every weekend or
yeah, every weekend you'll probably get away with it.
Okay, so you could potentially do ketamine once a week and
we
be okay?
We do it in the clinic once a week, lower doses than most street use.
Even if you were doing higher doses, if you went to K-Land?
You're probably going to get away with it.
Okay.
I'm not giving a blanket, you'll get away with it, but probably get away with it. Depending, if you're going to do a gram or 2 grams in a weekend, that may shoot you into bladderland eventually. And it may shoot you into states of mind that aren't that interesting or productive. Really, the question for anyone using is, what do you want from it? What are you going for? What is your basis? Is it, you know, there are a lot of great ways to use ketamine and other substances. A lot of erudition, a lot of self-awareness, so many great ways. That's why we use these substances, because they're really potentially beneficial. But you want to be in touch with yourself. What am I really doing? And you want to make it sacred as much as possible. You don't want to just toot it up and just be tooting all the time. It doesn't make sense to life. So the measure of a substance that's valuable to us is how it changes our lives and makes us, you know, more accomplished, more alive, more communitarian, more, you know, thoughtful human beings, connected human beings. Ketamine's a great connector because it reduces another part of the signature. It reduces one sense of ego. It's an ego lysing drug, and I should have put that in to the signature discussion, but it really reduces ego. It makes you feel small and part of the universe in a way in which you realize you're not that important. A lot of people on ketamine think they've experienced death, which you don't, of course, but there's a sense of that making peace with dying that occurs frequently. There's a lot of great, you know, perspectives that emerge from it, from the experience itself. Like, really, I'm making too much fuss of who I am. You know, I talk about negative and positive narcissism. It just means being involved with yourself, attached too much. And if we do spiritual practices, they're basically about not thinking so much about ourselves and broadening who we are and letting go of our sense of negative importance. I'm a miserable screw job. I can't do anything in the world. I hate myself. Or I'm the best thing that's happened, you know, since gold.
Well, Phil, I wonder if I'm doing it wrong, because I definitely get delusions of grandeur when I'm on ketamine sometimes. And maybe it's the heightened sense of meaning.
Give us an example.
Well, so like, okay, so I'll be on like a deep ketamine journey. I'm writing a book at the moment. And when I'm sober and I'm writing my book, I'm like, this is, you know, this could be a good book. People could like it. Sometimes I'll be on like a ketamine journey and I'm like, my book is going to save the world and it's going to be a paradigm shifting thing. Like I can get into these sort of like, there's such a heightened sense of meaning that all of a sudden I feel like I'm at the center of a cosmic drama and I'm somehow like uniquely important. And I know I'm not the only person who gets that from psychedelics, but I think sometimes there's an ego reducing quality, but sometimes it seems like there's an ego amplifying quality.
Well, the question, I'm glad you have that actually. I'm glad you feel excited and you feel like you're making a difference. The question is, are you bringing that back and imposing it on your, you know, those around you, your wife?
I mean, my ex-girlfriend really would say that I imposed it on people around
me. Well, she's your ex. That says something.
She'd be like, you know, Eamon, every time you're like high on ketamine, you say exactly the same thing as you say when you're sober, except you think it's new and super important.
Okay. I mean, the question, of course, is always watching yourself. Do you really believe it, that you're going to save the world? It's important to say, yes, I think my book will be a contribution, but saving the world's a little grandiose.
Well, you know, I'm kind of making a joke, but I think that also, I suffer from depression and anxiety. I've had struggles with that. And I think that one of the things is the contrast between being in a depressed state where you're like, I'm doing my best, but it doesn't matter that much. And then being in a state where you're like, wow, this really matters. And sometimes that can be even more amplified where, you know, not to the point of like a messianic perspective on it. I certainly don't think it's like a pathological narcissism.
Well, save the world gets to messianic.
Well, you know, I mean, but there is an amplification. So
I don't think that's bad. I think the question is how strongly you believe and act on it. So writing a great book and being enthusiastic about it, I think most great writers thought, oh, this is pretty, I often think this is pretty good. Right now I'm writing something I think is damn good, worthwhile. Is it perfect? Do I have to study? Do I have to make it, you know, re-edit it? Of course. I don't think it's that. I think it's a contribution. And I don't think I should be writing it if I don't think it's worthwhile. But I'm not looking at the audience also. So that's one of the amplifications I think, you know, creative people need to stay away from. Mm. Because when you start calculating how famous you're going to be, how much money you're going to make, how your book's going to sell 1 million copies, you know, you're getting lost. Write the book, or, you know, and then worry about the audience. And remember, the audience is not every man or every woman. The audience is always a segment. A lot of people won't read your book or my book. Mm. They won't think it's the greatest thing, you know, all of that.
I just hope a handful of people that go to Burning Man read my book.
Well, that's too modest, probably.
Well, okay, so we're coming to the end of the conversation. And I threatened to use myself as a cautionary tale earlier on. And this is one of the things that I was really excited to do in this conversation with you. I'm going to tell a brief story about my experience with ketamine as a way of bringing up some questions that I've heard others share. So 2016, I started using ketamine, and I didn't drink alcohol because I have alcoholism in my family, and I was a professional festival reviewer. So ketamine was my sort of like party fuel, like how I stayed up all night and how I, you know, and I noticed over time that I started having issues with my memory. And it felt like, intuitively, it felt related to the ketamine. The concerns I had were, one, the addictive quality of it, and two, this issue of memory. Now, I wasn't using it to the, you know, I wasn't using it every day. I wasn't using super high doses, but I definitely would have, you know, K-land transformative experiences, sometimes in inappropriate places, luckily always supported by people who would catch me as I proverbially fell. But I definitely had the suspicion that the ketamine experience was negatively impacting my memory. And my memory is certainly quite bad. And to the point where, like, if I have a ketamine experience now, I won't remember. I'll have a magical experience. I almost remember nothing afterwards from the experience, which is worrying. I have trouble remembering people's
names. It's not worrying. It comes with the drug. So let me take you up so far on it.
Okay.
So memory of a ketamine experience is variable depending on your sensitivity, how much you've done. A lot of people don't remember their ketamine experiences. And we in the clinic adjust dosage down if that's the case. We go up slowly so we see where the margin is, but people then will want to do more or will want to do more, and memory won't be very present. So memory for the journey itself is often not present or attenuated. That's true for all psychedelics. So if you look at any psychedelic experience, ayahuasca, anything, there will be memory generally for first experiences. But if you asked what happened with subsequent experiences, especially as you do many, you won't retain many memory. But short-term memory, when I was talking about longer-term memory, but short-term memory with ketamine, reduce the dose if you want to have memory. It's not, it just comes with the anesthesia aspect of ketamine.
So, okay, so that's helpful. I'm also just, I'm struggling memory generally. Like, can't remember people's names, see people that I've met, no idea who they are. Like, it's definitely been a worry in the memory change.
Well, observing you as the shrink I am, you don't have memory issues of consequence. You could have word issues. All of us do. But you're watching hard, so I don't, you know, you're fluent. You know, I'm giving you a mental status exam here. I don't see any issue with your memory. You're coherent, you follow through. Short-term memory is good. You resort to lists, but that's a good thing to do, I do too.
Well,
and then you have me. Remember, I'm 79, and I don't have memory issues. I have a very good memory, and I've done it over 25 years.
I often can see myself arguing for my limitations, be like, no, I have a problem. Help me with my problem that I have. And people are like, I'll help you by telling you don't have the problem.
And you don't have a remedy for that anyway. The other thing to note in journeys is that the experience of the journey is happening. So I tell people, even if they don't remember, they've had an internal experience, and bringing it back may well be incorporated in who you are. Without explicit memory, it will be incorporated in the nature of how you've changed or morphed from the experience. So a lot of people, you know, don't have good memory, and it's really adjustment of dosage if you want memory. But it doesn't mean you haven't had the experience.
I'm going to press this memory button a little bit harder, and here's why.
You didn't forget about it.
Well, I didn't forget. Well, no, because I've got a note right here about it. I've had a number of people say, does ketamine negatively affect your memory? And I did some research. I did modern layman's research, i.e. I Googled it and looked at some studies. But I did find there's a study in Frontier in 2014 that talked about hippocampal damage with high ketamine use, with like ketamine abuse.
In rats, we can't see the hippocampus.
Oh, then what are these guys talking about?
It's rats. I mean, rats have 23 million neurons. We got 30 billion. Rat studies are always suspect. They repeat, you know, Jason Wallach gives a good talk on rat studies. He's a great neuroscientist, like a new Sasha Shulgin. And rat studies are not transferable in general, and they contradict each other. So you can't see the hippocampus in humans. It would be fMRI, and how you would structure that would be very difficult. So I would assume you got a rat study. Take a look and see if I'm right.
Well, I'll take a look and see if you're right, and then I'll put a note in the show notes.
We don't have hippocampal damage. Even the people who are doing too much and too often don't have hippocampal damage. It would show up in other ways.
So there are people who are partying, polydrug partying, who are having memory compromising, whose memories are compromised. And I do think my memory has gotten a lot. I'm 41, and I feel like my memory is not where it should be for 41. It may be an anxiety thing where I'm just fixated on it, but it might also be maybe it's like the sleep thing. If you're staying up all night doing ketamine, then maybe like your memory is getting impaired by lack of sleep. But I feel like my memory has gotten somewhat impaired, and I thought it was ketamine. I just wanted you to tell me it wasn't, which I feel like you are telling me it wasn't.
Well, I mean, memory impairment from sleep deprivation certainly occurs. Memory impairment from depression certainly occurs. Memory impairment from anxiety certainly occurs.
Maybe it's those things, because I got those.
Yeah, you're a wreck.
So maybe I...
Come to our clinic.
Well, maybe I need... maybe I actually need more ketamine.
Oh, you should bathe in ketamine. Take a bath in ketamine liquid. But, spend a few thousand dollars and put a bathtub full of it. Get in it and just wear a snorkel.
Don't tempt me. This is exactly something I would do, by the way.
Lily invented the isolation tank with another guy. He did a lot of ketamine, LSD in the isolation tank. I don't recommend that, but I would probably drown. But, don't take that for real. That was a joke, audience, a joke.
And that brings us to, I think, the last. So we talked about addiction. We talked about tolerance. We talked about potential kidney bladder damage. We talked about memory loss. The last thing that I just wanted to touch on, and these are all things that I either got questions about or that, from audience members. The last thing is about psychosis. And maybe this is about contraindications before using ketamine. I have a story of a friend who definitely had a psychotic episode and was doing ketamine constantly. And the community basically feels that
I've seen that too.
So
we're probably talking about the same guy.
Yeah.
I think I saw him.
We're kind of in the same community, so
I think it's the same guy probably.
So ketamine, high consistent ketamine use can cause psychosis.
Well, you're disoriented all the time. I mean, how do you make sense out of your life? You're screwing your life up in your judgment. You don't have a monitor. Ketamine dependency really screws up how you view the world, yourself, et cetera. And you're in an altered state, a very powerful altered state. So that altered state looks psychotic. It is, because it's not in touch with reality, as much as we understand what that means. So yeah, you could do that. Don't screw yourself up like that. It's not a good idea.
So what I'm getting from this conversation in terms of adverse effects and being wise in our relationship to this, which is essentially, use this medicine intentionally. You can use it in a community setting. It doesn't need to be on a therapist's or a psychiatrist's couch in order to give you benefits, but it does have a physiologically addictive quality. It can create harm if you become addicted to it. And so—
Let's call it dependency. I really don't like addiction.
Okay, fair. I like that you reframe a lot of words. I appreciate that. Dependence is a better expression. Let's be mindful that we're not becoming dependent upon it.
Well, let's add to that a little bit, then we'll stop. The dependency comes from desire to use the substance. What's the basis of that desire? It's multiple, but one aspect of the desire is, I don't want to be here, don't like my life, let me turn to ketamine. So there's the inherency of a substance, opiates is a particular model, alcohol is another one, where the substance itself produces dependency. And ultimately, I think ketamine does that. But much of the move towards a dependent profile is because I want to have the ketamine experience and not have this life experience. I think that's the main motivation.
And that's important when we're dealing with anything, even if that's not even a substance, if it's shopping or if it's gambling, if it's a process addiction. Yeah, any way to escape this experience.
But some, and those experiences too are dependency forming. I mean, cutting, which we see a lot in younger women, especially some men, is a very dependency-making experience. People repeat it, hooked on the trance. So trance states are really dependency forming. Ketamine's a trance state.
Okay, Phil, we have just a few minutes left, and you've been so gracious with your time today. So the way we're going to land this wide-ranging conversation is just a little note on where things are going next. What are you most excited about? You've got some stuff coming up, and you mentioned before we started recording this intersection of psychedelics and spirituality. Tell us what to look out for, and also where our listeners can find you and look into your work.
You know, what motivates me at this age is trying to keep as much as possible towards creating love, sharing, and connection. I don't see much else of value in the world other than creativity, and I love being creative. But I think, you know, once I was a revolutionary, I still am, but I don't think it's a violent revolution. I think we have to defend ourselves and protect ourselves. But the path of love, sharing, connection, imperfect as it is in cooperatives and collaborative formats, is what I've come to as the only really worthwhile social path. Where you can hear me, well, I'm all over the place now. I hope people will be interested in our Ketamine Training Center programs. Ketamine Research Foundation needs support. It's by donation. We're doing lots of research. We're doing a study on end of life with 5 sites across the United States, conscious dying, conscious living, to promote humanization of treatment and palliative care medicine. We're going to do a conference on that. We're looking at doing a vets program to train veterans to be co-facilitators to other veterans who have PTSD. We've got a lot of things going, and we have an organization that promotes the quality of care. The other thing we're always involved in is ethics. We have a ketamine ethics statement. We abhor what's going on with the misuse or sexual violation or financial violations that are going on. And we really want to look at and develop methodologies that are coterminous, that are based on use of alternative substances, and incorporate them into very human and extraordinarily beneficial kinds of interventions for human beings. And that's where we're at. So those are some of my projects.
Beautiful. Well, we'll have all that in the show notes. Phil, really appreciated spending time with you. And I appreciate that you said that I was fancy. That's a big takeaway for me from the episode. But also, you really helped me understand a lot more about ketamine. And I think our listeners, people who go to festivals, people who are interacting with this medicine a lot, had a lot of their questions answered. I know, because a lot of questions came in.
I go to festivals too.
Yeah. Oh yeah, you've been to Burning Man.
Well, I go to, you know, Lightning in a Bottle. My son, Helix Wolfson Poliamori, was mayor of Lightning in a Bottle for 3 years.
Yeah, we need to get Polly on this podcast.
He's great on podcasts. So,
but like as Polly, you know, not...
Well, whatever. Yeah,
or maybe as a number of characters.
He's doing the metaverse right now in his own way. Nice. So I appreciate being with you and your thoughtfulness and your great good memory.
Touche. Thank you so much, Phil. Thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival. If you like the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.